This episode of Addiction, an Hour with Hour, is brought to you by Gaming Laboratories International. GLI is a world-class testing, inspections, and certification company committed to delivering the highest quality land-based, lottery, and iGaming testing and assessment services around the world. GLI provides suppliers, operators, and regulators with expert guidance for navigating the future of gaming and ensuring gaming innovations meet regulatory standards with confidence in more than 710 jurisdictions. For more information, visit GamingLabs.com. Hello and welcome to another grandstanding episode of Addiction, an Hour with Hour. It's a very exciting day on the podcast today, but I'll get into that in just a minute. I'm one of your hosts, John Bruford. I'm generally the only non-doctor on the podcast, for which I'm routinely mocked for my lack of a doctorate, joined by the good, the eminent Dr. Michael Hour. Dr. Hour. Hello.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm okay. How's your doctorate today? Is a doctorate like a thing? Do you shine it every day?
I'm not sure. I think it's not something you can touch, you know? Like only shine
it's a
things
state
that
of
you
being.
Can, I can touch, like my guitar's back there.
a doctorate is a state of being and a sense of when you got your doctorate, did you feel complete?
No, because I wouldn't publish papers, you know, still. So, you know, I just published another one 2 days ago. It's a lot of work, man. Lots of work.
Yeah, well, it's a full-time job, isn't it, being an academic?
Yeah, I'm just a researcher.
For most academics.
I'm not.
Oh, you're a multifaceted individual. Sorry.
Yes.
But you're a very excited multifaceted individual today because we've got somebody you've really wanted on the podcast. Really wanted. He's so excited about this.
It's true. I mean, like, he's not making it up.
So listen, I'm going to tell you a story, right? Years and years ago, I was one of my best mates, Juliet, right? We were sharing a flat in London. And I was having a bit of a bad time. And one of my clients said, hey, why don't you take a bit of time off? Like, you're bringing everybody down. Why don't you take a holiday? So I go back to the flat and I say to Jules, I think maybe I might take a bit of a holiday. You've got some time off. Shall we go away somewhere? And she said, well, should we have a look on lastminute.com? See if we can go to Egypt. Now, I'd never been abroad before, right? I was 26, never been abroad before, never owned a passport. So I got my passport. Got the Egypt stuff ready, got my jabs and all of that stuff. And we go to Egypt, right? I mean, it's like being in a foreign country. But it was amazing. And we did this little day trip. We were on the Red Sea coast and we did this day trip way inland through the Sahara to the Valley of the Kings. Now, Jules was mad interested in Egyptology, right? And she'd been reading these books by this particular he's a professor, I think, a guy called Kent Weeks, big name in Egyptology. We're walking through the Valley of the Kings, and I thought she was going to crap her pants because we see these guys, you know, in all the proper gear, and she just went, oh, my God, it's Dr. Kent Weeks. Like a kid in the 1960s seeing the Beatles, she went absolutely bonkers, and I'm like, well, go over and say hello. She's like, I can't. It's Dr. Kent Weeks. I'm like, no, but he probably never gets this. And he'll probably really appreciate that his work is out there and it's inspiring people to come to Egypt where he is. And she's like, no, I can't. Basically, I told you this story because that's what Michael is doing right now. Right now, Michael is going, oh, my God, it's Dr. Dan Lieberman, who is the clinical professor of psychiatry at George Washington University. Dr. Lieberman, Dan, Welcome. Thank you for joining us and giving Michael his probably highlight of the year so far.
Well, thank you for that lovely introduction. I only hope I can live up to it.
God, me too.
Of course, there's I'll ask you all sorts of questions from your book, so hopefully you will.
Hopefully you remember it.
You know, I have to say, I had a professor Weeks experience only once in my life. I was in a gas station. Some guy recognized me, and I just wanted to give him a big hug. First and only time.
Okay. Wow. We're gonna make up, you know, for this hug at one of the one future conference. Hopefully we attend together.
It kind of happened to me, right? I was working at this publishing company. I was early 20s, 23, 24, something like that. And this guy who I'd been working with for about a year came down with this look of reverence on his face, came over to my desk. And he said, I didn't realize. And he named the first magazine I'd ever worked on that he was a subscriber to and a huge fan of. And I didn't realize it was you. And I'm like, yeah. And that was it. That was the whole interaction. It was really, really unexciting. And I hope to this day he's forgotten about that. Yeah.
But so anyway. So your book, The Molecule of More, is very knowledgeable. I mean, very informative. And I mean, there are things in there which I would have never connected, like, you know, political attitude, migration, immigration, you know, those kinds of things. Of course, you know, we are, yeah, John.
Just take a step back here, Michael, right? Because you both know what the book's about because you've read
it multiple times. Yeah, we'll come to that. Okay.
So tell me what the book's about. Yeah, tell me the nuts and bolts.
No, I can't. Dan has to tell us what the book's about. Please, Dan.
In a word, the book's about dopamine. You know, it's funny, John. You said when you got your doctorate, your MD degree, did you feel complete? And I think Michael and I can both say no. It was just the beginning. But you know, I worked my way up the academic ladder, like Michael, writing tons and tons of papers. And the thing about these papers is, you can spend easily 2 or 3 years designing the study, collecting the data, and then writing it up. And then fewer than a dozen people will ever read it. So, you know, I kind of slaved away in the academic galleys and reached professor. And that was the end. It was the first time in my life I'd ever kind of reached the end. And at that point, I decided that I wanted to write something that people would actually want to read. And I had this background in addictions. And so I thought, well, dopamine is the obvious answer. Dopamine has such a profound influence over our lives. And it is such an interesting chemical. And so I wrote this book about dopamine. And really, a lot of it is focused on that dopamine is more than what people think it is. A lot of people think of dopamine as the pleasure molecule or the reward molecule. It has a much more general purpose, though, and that is to orient us to the future, to how things could be better for us, which is why my co-author, Mike Long, and I called it the molecule of more. And we just explore the many different areas of human behavior where dopamine plays a guiding role.
Then what would happen if a person would be deprived of dopamine?
Yeah. So, you know, we contrast dopamine, which is about the future, with the here and now neurotransmitters, the ones that don't make us think about making our lives better, but just enjoying the present moment. It has to do with social contacts and emotions and sensory experiences. And I think that we all differ to some degree in where our emphasis lies. Some of us are more dopaminergic. Others are more here and now. And so I think if somebody were very low in dopamine, there's a number of different ways they might look. Negative way, they could be like the marijuana smoking basement dweller who doesn't have a job and lives in his mom's basement and has no ambition. And just wants to live hedonistically for the moment. That's the negative. But we can also see a positive. And that might be a Buddhist monk who has worked very hard to overcome desire and very much lives in the present moment, meditating beneath a tree and not doing, but rather just being. And I think that's the opposite side of the coin of dopamine.
That's an interesting point. I mean, let's imagine an alien observing the human race, right? They see a Buddhist monk and the basement dweller. They would think, hey, I mean, these guys are basically doing the same thing, nothing. But what's interesting, you know, like when, I mean, dopamine is discussed in that context, it's a very recent phenomenon, isn't it? I mean, you write in your book that it was actually detected in 1957.
Yes, that's right. In the recent decades, we have learned so much about the brain. In the United States, I can't remember what it was. There was some recent decade that was dubbed the Decade of the Brain by the National Institute of Health. And lots of resources were dedicated to better understanding it. And then we started getting these PET scans in which we could actually track individual neurotransmitters in the brain, like dopamine, find out when they're active, when they're not active. And it has just radically expanded how we understand not only the brain, but also human nature.
I dug up my neurobiology book that was, you know, from my course, you know, it's when I studied psychology in the 1990s, and dopamine is not mentioned in it. You know, it's crazy.
Oh my goodness, like, is that right? The whole textbook.
Yeah, whole textbook. But that's that was in 90. I don't know what the book's probably from the early 90s, and there is no mention of dopamine at all. And there you see, you know, how far we have come, and that something is actually really happening. You know, in research. Yeah. In understanding of the brain and, you know, its mechanisms.
We've made so much progress in recent years, and yet the brain is so complicated that brain science still lags well behind studies of other organs in the body, like the heart, the liver, the pancreas. We're making progress, and the progress is absolutely fascinating, but there's still far more that we do not understand compared to what we do understand.
You said before, and I think it's worth explaining and going deeper, that dopamine is not the pleasure hormone, but you write in your book, it's actually the wanting that sort of, you know, is driven by the dopamine, but not the liking. And, you know, I like this when you write about the mice licking their lips, smacking their lips, that's the indicator of, you know, liking. And pressing the lever of wanting. And I think that's something that sort of maybe you can explain a bit in more detail.
Yeah, sure. You know, there's this wonderful quotation in Winnie the Pooh, a children's book by A.A. Milne. You know, it's the last place you'd expect to find a lesson on neuroscience. But there is a section in which Christopher Robin asks Pooh, what is it that you like the best in the whole world? And Pooh's immediate reaction is to say, eating honey. But then he stops and he says, there's a moment just before eating honey that's even better, but he doesn't know what it's called. And that's dopamine. So for Pooh, he still likes honey. But sometimes we can actually want something and then not like it. And I think that the concept of buyer's remorse is a really good example of that, in which we get all excited about an upcoming purchase. We may read all about it online. It's all we can talk about with our friends. And then we get it, and we're kind of bored with it. It doesn't mean anything to us. I know people who order things through the mail, and they're terribly excited about it. And then the package arrives, and they don't even open the package. And the reason is that they are actually looking for dopamine. And as I mentioned, dopamine's about the future. We get a lot of dopamine when we think about possibilities, like the possibility of eating honey. But when the future becomes the present, dopamine is not operative anymore. Other brain neurochemicals have to take over. And so dopamine shuts down to make room. And dopamine goes and pays attention to the next thing. if we're able to make that transition smoothly from the future to the present, we can get just as much pleasure from the things we buy. We can get both wanting and liking. The problem is, though, that many modern people, myself included, have difficulty making that transition. And so when the thing we anticipate becomes a thing that we have and dopamine shuts down, it doesn't feel good. It actually feels bad.
In your book, you draw the analogy, of course, and I mean, you trace it back to the evolutionary origins. And of course, among gatherers, hunters and gatherers, dopamine was responsible for them going out, right, taking risks. And you write there, I mean, you mentioned this example that they walk by a bush and suddenly they see berries grow. And of course, they remember that because that's, you know, crucial, important survival information. Okay, this, you know, bush has berries, and they remember this. And that's something, you know, without the dopamine, they wouldn't go out, they wouldn't sort of have hunted the mammoth because they knew, okay, there's a chance we're gonna die, or there's a chance the saber-toothed tiger is gonna, you know, attack us and eat us. But what in now today with, you know, the digital technology, the social media, the gambling, the drugs, etc., this circuit can be hijacked.
Yes, that's right. Dopamine is very much involved in learning. You know, you mentioned that people are walking around looking for food. They come across a bush with berries. Dopamine fires. It's the anticipation of a better life. And the memory that that bush produces berries gets locked in. And that's why it's so much easier to learn when we're studying something that interests us. Mm. Interest is a marker of dopamine. I think we've all tried to learn material that we just don't care about. And it's torture. You got to go it over and over again. But if it's something you're passionate about, you read it once and you remember it, maybe forever. So what does that have to do with gambling and drug addiction? Well, essentially, both of these things stimulate dopamine to a very powerful degree. With drug addiction, it's just a chemical blast. It bypasses all of the brain's checks and balances and just artificially stimulates dopamine, making drug users think that the drug is the single most important thing for their future, for them to be successful, which of course is the opposite. The drugs are destroying their future, but it's tricking the brain. With gambling, you know, there's always this possibility of a life-changing win. And so these things are teaching the brain lessons. And the primary lesson is, just like the evolutionary ancestor is going to come back to that bush over and over again to gather berries, today we're going to come back to the drugs. We're going to come back to the gambling. We're going to come back to the compulsive sex and the other addictions over and over again, because dopamine has locked it in our brain. This is the most important thing.
So why do people continue to take drugs, although it's bad for them? And they, of course, realize it's bad once, you know, the kick sort of, you know, goes down.
Yeah, it's a great question, because if you work with drug users, a lot of them will tell you, I started out using it because it felt good, but it doesn't feel good anymore, and I can't stop using it. And the reason that happens is because dopamine not only gives us pleasure and reward, it also gives us craving. Mm-hmm. And craving is an intensely unpleasant situation. You know, we've all experienced craving. Maybe you're on a diet, you crave food. Maybe you set your alarm 30 minutes early to get up and exercise, mm-hmm. and you crave more sleep. It's incredibly powerful, and it often makes us act contrary to our own better judgment. So that's what they're doing. After a while, they're no longer seeking pleasure. They're seeking relief from craving.
Because, I mean, you mentioned in your book that if you, you know, you anticipate food, dopamine is released, you eat, and then you don't crave more food because you have eaten, you know, and your bodily functions, you know, are satisfied, but with drugs it's differently. It's different. You take the cocaine and you want the next line of cocaine.
I just want to chip in here, and I know you two are the ones with the doctorates, right? But I've probably had more drugs than both of you, so I can definitely comment on that. Now, cocaine's a really tricky one because, like with a lot of cocaine's a social drug, really, fundamentally, and it's often used by people who are a little shy, a lot insecure, in the same exact same way as alcohol is. And one of the keys to cocaine is that it's a very short hit. Cocaine, you'll be up and down in an hour, right? Heroin, I find, is the really interesting one with addicts. And I have a lot of friends who've been heroin addicts. And almost all of them aren't anymore. Well, I mean, they still are addicts, but they don't use heroin anymore. And what a lot of them have said to me in the past is that the first time... And this ties in with I think, how the brain works and something that you were talking about earlier, Dan. The first time is unbelievably intense and extraordinary. And a lot of subsequent use is hoping for that again. Now, I think I was talking to my kids about, not about heroin use, that'll come later, but... I was talking to my kids about how when they experience things, because so my kids are like 13, 11, and 8. I was talking to them about how when they experience things now, they're really intense. Like when they get frustrated, it's absolutely overpowering. They want to smash whatever they're playing with because it's the first time they've experienced that. And when they have, like my daughter is right now, she has her first crush. And it's intense because it's the first time it's happened. And when they all fall in love for the first time, that first love, it's indelible. We all remember our first love because it's the first time that it ever happened. And there is a, I'm not going to say a purity to it, but there is a lack of cynicism attached to it. There is a lack of wariness attached to it, which comes with all subsequent things because the first one usually goes horribly wrong. And I wonder what role that plays in it, because everybody that I'm aware of that takes heroin the first time then is violently sick. And that's a physical reaction, a perfectly natural physical reaction to essentially a bunch of poison in your body, which is making you go, ooh, this is the best sleep ever. But I wonder how much of the intensity and I wonder how much of that is a sort, almost a lack of cynicism from the brain, and that being the first time and all of those things just firing for the first time ever in that way and trying to recapture that, which is, of course, completely impossible.
Yeah. Yeah, I had a friend who became addicted to cocaine, and he said that you never get to the lady behind the mirror. You always feel like you're just on the edge of breaking through to something wonderful. And so you go again and again and again, but you never get there. And I think that that speaks to the molecule of more. Dopamine is only interested in things that are new, because things you've experienced before are no longer opportunities to make your future better. Those are already in the bag. And so the technical term for it is tolerance, that you do something, it feels great, and the next time you do it, it doesn't feel as great, and each subsequent time, less and less great. The brain is adapting not to respond to this because it wants you to go out and find something even better. It wants you to go out and find more. And so you develop tolerance for the pleasure, but you still have the craving. And so you become enslaved to something that's doing nothing for you.
I'm a slave to sugar.
It's not so different.
No, it's really not. And it's far, far more difficult to avoid.
Yeah.
I mean, it's in everything. I mean, I can just go and not buy drugs.
Yeah. I mean, pretty much every grocery store is a drug department, isn't it? I mean, you walk into a Walmart, look in the US.
You say this, right?
Yeah.
Seriously. So I read a book. Oh, shit. Siri's just popped up on my phone because she thinks I said Siri. For fuck's sake. There's a book by, I'm probably going to get the names wrong. I think it's two American neurologists of some stripe called Grain Brain. I read it about 10 or 12 years ago. But it was really fascinating because it was talking about food as a source of essentially as a source of dopamine and the role of gluten in the brain as a dopamine release. And that's why we associate certain, or part of why we associate certain foods as comfort foods. Because they give us that. And pasta is like way up there. And white bread is way up there. And that's really fascinating. But I think that's where you're going with that, Mike. Like you walk into a shop and you're looking at shelves of dopamine.
I mean, you go into a Walmart in the US. I mean, you could feed probably an entire country for a month with all of the carbs in there.
Yeah, the carbs, the sugar,
the soft drinks.
Yeah, soft drinks. But you know, I think what's even more interesting is the packaging, because they've got psychology experts working for them. You know, these processed food companies are basically neuroscience laboratories, and that's why everything is new and improved. That'll get dopamine going. Christmas Captain Crunch, for a limited time only, act quickly. And so they're kind of just selling us these packages of processed chemicals that are horrible for our bodies, but they know how to get our dopamine system running, even before we open the box. And so these are the dominant products on the shelves.
But you don't look like you consume too many of them.
Looks can be deceiving.
No, we saw you before I stand up. So, but you know, this ties in nicely into something I also wanted to discuss: novelty. Novelty is something that, and we discussed this, you know, in a couple of recordings before, that you know there is novelty all around us all the time. We are not bored anymore, right? There's always entertainment. There's always something new. And that's also very relevant when we discuss dopamine.
Just think as well. So myself and Michael specialize in the gambling industry largely. Me as a journalist, Michael as the great Dr. Michael Auer. But there's a very specific... it's not unique to the casino industry, but if you look at online slot games, the turnover of online slot games, the amount of new product that's pushed through week on week on, I mean, it's absolutely staggering. The shelf life of these games is incredibly short, extraordinarily short. There are very few games that are anywhere after a month. And of course, there are so many as a result of this that it's even harder for games to stay sort of, you know, finding games is one of the difficulties for players, etc. And I wonder how that ties in with what Michael's saying here, novelty. And you were just saying, Dan, about how dopamine is always looking for that new thing. And I wonder if that, because Michael, stop me if I'm wrong. I don't think that specifically has been looked at as a factor in problematic play in online slots.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not an expert in gambling, but I think that in some ways pornography is similar.
Yeah, sure.
And I ran across a study in which they put young men in a brain scanner and showed them pornographic images. And sure enough, their dopamine circuits became active. They lit up. And then they showed them a little while later, they showed them the same pictures again, and dopamine didn't light up the second time they saw them. And then they showed them new pornographic pictures and dopamine lit up. And I think that's what's going on with the gambling. People are playing the slot machines and they're getting dopamine hits, but after a while that goes away and maybe they'll be less likely to play. The gambling site's going to get less revenue. They put a new game on, they restore the dopamine, they increase the addictiveness again, and their bottom line reflects that.
I mean, in gambling, it's I mean, I'm not sure, you know, how aware people are of this, but in gambling, what I see, it's very similar to other industries. There are brands. Okay, so let's say you walk into a Walmart and you buy the product that you think is good, right? Or you buy the car make that, you know, you have learned is of high quality, like a Cadillac or whatever, you know, whatever sort of, you know, you prefer. And what I also see, John, is that every manufacturer of games out there has one, two, or three games that have been there for sometimes decades, you know, like some, you know, Egyptian themed game. One game, you know, it's like a buffalo, you know, a Chinese sort of themed game, and people play. So it's also the familiarity. It's not just a novelty, but some games are, I think, for the players, like coming home, you know. You go to a casino, you haven't been there before, but you see familiarity because you see the game that you've been playing at home in other casinos, and it comforts you too. So it's this balance between, okay, novelty and the familiarity. And with the novelty, I think what you mentioned in the book is that, you know, you have the reward prediction error, right? I think that's important concept here. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, sure. So reward prediction error is when you are expecting a certain level of goods or value, and it turns out that you predicted wrong and there's actually more. And essentially that's what dopamine is. And so it can be a simple mathematical formula. Dopamine release equals the real reward minus the expected reward. And let me just give you an example of that. Let's say that you're walking down the street going to work and suddenly you realized a new bakery has just opened up. You didn't know that bakery was there, and so the expected reward was zero. The real reward is the bakery. You go in, you get a delicious croissant, cup of coffee, and that's absolutely wonderful, and you got a nice dopamine hit from noticing that new bakery. Now, a couple weeks later, you're walking down the street, you see the bakery, well, you know it's there. And so the expected reward is exactly equal to the actual reward, and so now the dopamine is zero. So the first time you went in that bakery, you might have expected it to be an enduring source of pleasure. How wonderful that this French bakery is now in my neighborhood. This is going to change my life for the better. But unfortunately, it doesn't really. It just changes it for the better for a short period of time until reward prediction error has been corrected.
And I mean, we also look for uncertainty, right? Because there is this, you know, quote in the Matrix movie. You probably saw it with Keanu Reeves. So when Agent Smith captures Morpheus, like Lawrence Fishburne, and he tells him, the first Matrix was like a completely safe environment for everybody. No risk, you know, everybody got everything, like communism, you know, everybody was happy, everybody got the equal share, and the human brains didn't accept it, you know, they perished. This simulation of the human world didn't work because there was no risk, no harm, no danger. Everybody sort of, you know, was supposed to be happy. And that's not, you know, the world that, you know, we are built to live in, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. And I think that's such a timely topic because everyone now is talking about artificial intelligence, and artificial intelligence potentially has the capacity with robots to produce all kinds of goods and services so that anybody can have any material possession that they want. We'll all be safe. We'll all be rich. We'll all be happy. And that might sound nice from our current point of view of being poor and in danger, but I don't think people are going to be happy. And I think that the artificial intelligent agents are going to have to create environments for us in which we suffer deprivation, because otherwise we can't enjoy the getting good things.
Yeah. Hopefully the Matrix is still a few years away from us. but I mean, what you also mentioning in your book, a couple interesting cases. And I mean, I think they by accident discovered that, for example, Parkinson's patients who got medication started to gamble compulsively, and that was also related to dopamine, correct?
Yes, that's right. That's right. Dopamine is complicated. There are actually three primary pathways dopamine can take in the brain, and they're all focused on making the future better, but they do it in different ways. So the pathway that we're all most familiar with is the reward pathway. That gives us anticipation, pleasure, and also craving. There's another reward, though, that goes to the frontal lobes. And this is a pathway that's not functioning quite right in attention deficit disorder. And what that pathway allows us to do is it allows us to focus on the longer future and use abstract tools like planning, logic, mathematics, in order to accomplish our long-term goals. And finally, there's the movement pathway. And this is the one that we have trouble with in Parkinson's disease. The movement pathway translates intention into actual action. It takes what we want to do and allows us to move our muscles in order to do it. And so people who have Parkinson's disease, they move very slowly. It's very hard for them to initiate movements. And so we treat them with dopamine boosting drugs. The problem is that these drugs are not specific just to the movement pathway. They also amplify the desire pathway, the reward pathway. And in some cases, that has led to addictions like addictive gambling.
And also, I think sexual
addiction. Yeah, mm-hmm. That's right. There's this one man who his wife had to quit her job because she had to monitor him 24 hours a day because he was so hypersexual.
Mm. John, don't say anything. Be quiet.
I'm going to have to, though, because there's this thing like, so, I mean, as I have mentioned on this podcast and on our other podcast, there's a bunch of things I'm addicted to. And, you know, I largely just keep myself out of harm's way. Because... I don't know whether this is, I don't know, maybe I'm just at that right kind of age where I can look around and say, kids today, they don't know they're born, etc. And, oh, aren't the police getting younger? But with things like most, certainly men, most men really quite enjoy sex. I think I can say that with some certainty. Sex drives are very different in different people. It's generally it's seen as it's a good thing. It's a nice thing. It's a nice thing that people do together, consenting adults, etc. I guess where I'm going with this is I don't really like with the addictions that I have. They are shit like sugar, nicotine, caffeine, probably not alcohol, but the sugar element of that means it's very muddy water. Basically, I don't do any drugs anymore. I don't have any stimulants if I can help it. With the sex addiction thing, though, with many addictions in general, I do feel like the role of personal responsibility has been diminished over time, particularly now. Because I've always said in gambling, if people are pissed off with how operators work, they should go to the regulator, because the operators are working within the rules that are specified in order to keep their licenses, right? Regulation overlaps with personal responsibility. It doesn't replace it. And that's the same for regulation for drinking alcohol. It's the same for regulation for most types of regulation. They do not absolve people of their personal responsibility. And I do feel that there is a willingness in recent years for people to attempt to absolve themselves of their part in this. The part where, you know, like you've seen people who've had serious allegations of sexual misconduct against them, and they've tried to use as a defense sex addiction. Like, I wrote a column for a magazine I used to edit, and the column just basically said, if in doubt, don't take your dick out. If you're not sure, maybe just keep it in your trousers. Perhaps if it's in a work environment, don't take your cock out. Nobody needs to see that. Maybe I'm missing something here, because, you know, you've also heard of things over the years where people have suggested maybe they have alcoholism, that's why they were caught drink driving and they should be let off or whatever. Maybe it's more knowledge in society about addiction that means people try and play the game a little bit. Well, I don't know. What are your thoughts on this? Am I bonkers? Am I just a bad human being?
No, I think you're raising an incredibly difficult problem, and that is, to what degree is moral turpitude a biological problem, and to what degree is it a spiritual problem? And that is incredibly difficult for scientists to answer. Scientists don't have tools to study and measure spiritual issues like goodness. We can measure the outcomes. We can give people surveys about morality, but it's difficult. And I think that scientists have this tendency to want to explain things based on materialist explanations. And materialism is deterministic. Two billiard balls knocked together, they're going to ricochet in a very deterministic way. And so when you get scientific materialistic expectations, it crowds out the moral side of things. And so it's an incredibly important question, especially from the point of view of criminal justice. How much do we hold people responsible? But it's one that science has done a very poor job of addressing.
Yeah, I mean, it's ultimately about free will, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Neuroscientists will tell you that we don't have free will. I don't believe that, but there's no evidence of it. Mm. Yeah, I'm sorry I interrupted you.
No, I mean, absolutely agree. I mean, and people behave on a continuum, right? I mean, let's say you have somebody with Tourette's syndrome. I mean, I think we can all agree they can't help it.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
They can't help it.
No, impossible.
And impossible, exactly. And that can maybe also apply to, you know, other, like, you know, criminal behavior. Somebody's driven to do whatever.
If they're delusional, they think this person is the devil. Yeah, they're not responsible. Yeah,
exactly. So, I mean, I think that's...
You know, here's the way I deal with it in practical terms. Let's say that I'm treating somebody with an alcohol use disorder, and they relapse and they drink. I'm not going to blame them, because that's out of their control. But let's say that they stop coming into treatment. I will blame them, because I think that that is in their control. And furthermore, I know that if for most people, if they stick with the treatment, they will get better. So in practical terms, I say, all right, maybe you're not responsible for relapses. Maybe you're not responsible for certain behaviors, but you are certainly responsible for showing up every week at the treatment appointment. Because if you do that, you will probably overcome your addiction. That's where I draw the line. Responsible for treatment, maybe less responsible for relapses.
Mm. It's a good point. I'd like to...
Yeah, can't argue with that.
Come back full circle to the dopamine topic, what I found, I mean, and I didn't notice that connection before, and that's where you link the dopamine to migration. And I mean, I found that's extremely fascinating, and it completely makes sense, right? You know, that in certain societies you have much, you know, you have inventions, creativity, and in others not, because the people who actually did that before, they left.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Yeah, the United States is a country of immigrants. And per capita, I think the United States produces the most Nobel Prize winners. We've got the most Wild West economy, or certainly one of the most Wild West economies in the world. Lots and lots of innovation. And, you know, the United States is criticized a great deal for, you know, lack of standards and that sort of thing. But if somebody has a brilliant idea and they want to make it a reality, they're going to go to a place where that's most likely to happen. And so in some ways you get a dopamine drain from the old countries to the new countries. And I believe we quoted a study in our book that found on average Europeans have less active dopamine systems compared to Americans.
You mentioning like a couple how do you spell it in English? Alleles?
Alleles,
yeah. So yeah. Those are gene types in modifications, like versions of genes, right?
Yes.
And certain versions lead to more dopamine, and they are more abundant, let's say, in the United States than in the old world.
Yeah, that's right. Just like some people have blue eyes and others have brown, the receptor that reacts to dopamine comes in a number of different varieties, which we call alleles, some more active than others. And there's a concentration of more active ones in the United States, more less active ones in Europe.
Yeah, I'm an outlier, okay. I always wanted to leave.
Yeah, there's going to be variation throughout. But you know, I think in the United States, there's also more risk-taking. You know, John, you mentioned this culture of safety. I think that's in all Western societies right now, where it's all about safety. You got to wear a helmet when you ride your bike, seatbelt laws, et cetera, et cetera. But I think it's more in Europe, and I think it makes it a little more difficult to innovate.
I couldn't agree more here. I mean, there's lots of law. The other day I read an article about Germany, and I mean, they are the worst. I'm sorry if anybody's listening here with like that. So they developed during the development of a tank, okay, like the military car type of vehicle, they had to comply with like emission laws, you know, that even like a pregnant woman could use it safely. I mean, you won't win a war with that approach.
So no, you do not.
If, you know, weapons have to meet, you know, these kinds of standards, then thank God, you know, nobody's coming to seize us.
Yeah, that's scary.
And that's also... you're also mentioning that there is a correlation between dopamine and, of course, also geographical and the world with bipolar disorder.
Yes, that's right. You know, if somebody has a very active dopamine system, there's a good chance they are going to be an innovator. They're going to be focused on things that are new. They might be very, very successful. They might be very, very hard workers. And so they might not be happy, but from the point of view of the human race, they are an asset. They push the human race forward. But what's interesting is that if you go a little bit more, you get mental illness. And so genius and insanity are next door neighbors. And so places like the United States, where there is higher levels of dopamine among the people, there will also be higher levels of mental illness. As you may know, Newton, Sir Isaac Newton, spent some time in a psychiatric asylum because he had some insanities. Einstein's son had schizophrenia and spent most of his life institutionalized and died in a psychiatric hospital. And it's very, very common that you have these geniuses and they will have temporary periods of insanity, or they will have sons and daughters who have mental illness. They're very, very close together. And I think of it sort of like an Italian sports car. All right. If you want a nice, reliable car, get a Toyota Camry. You know, it'll run forever and never give any troubles. If you want the highest performance, get a handmade Italian car, but it's going to break down a lot. And I think it's the way with the human brain. The highest performing brains are also most likely to break down a lot in terms of mental illness. And dopamine plays a big role.
Yeah, sure. I mean, this is, for me, very similar to, you know, laws of physics, right? I mean, you know, the overall energy is constant, you know, and you can't sort of, you know, create more than there is. And if you push the energy into one system, it's just gonna be missing in the other system, and it might lead to issues.
Yeah, that's right. Nothing in biology is free. There's always a trade-off. Yeah,
exactly. I mean, I have lots of muscle, but I also have brain. So I'm the exception. I mean, I never learned to speak proper English, but that's, you know, can't get everything at the same time.
That's right. That's right.
So true. Sure. No, English is exceptionally good though, Michael. You know that.
It is, but my
pronunciation. I mean, I just at some point of time, I just gave up, you know. People understand me usually.
Yes.
But I was in Memphis like 3 weeks ago and I liked the U.S. South. I think, you know, I lived there in one of my previous lives. And there, it's really hard, you know. They don't understand me. I don't understand at first, you know, because the pronunciation, you know, is, and if, you know, an Austrian guy comes to whatever, you know, place somewhere rural and starts asking for some food, it's like, what?
You know,
I will even have trouble with a very thick Southern accent. And it's possible that in 50 years, it's going to be a separate dialect because they're moving apart.
Really, still? Although with media and everything? And
surprisingly, yes. Yeah.
Wow, really? Like, what's an example?
Oh, boy, it's hard for me. It's hard for me to think of it. But I've just been in situations where a Southerner will say something and I'll just be drawing a blank. And I just don't know what you said.
Okay. I'm happy I'm not the only one.
If you're struggling to understand somebody or struggling to be understood by somebody, this is a top tip, right? If you want to imitate somebody, don't try and imitate their voice. You try and imitate their rhythm.
Yeah, absolutely.
Rhythm and pattern of their speech.
Yeah.
So if you try and give that back to them, that's what they're used to hearing.
Mm.
So next time you're there, Michael, change the rhythm of your speech because Europeans speak fast.
Yeah.
Slow it down.
I know.
Slow it down and draw it out.
Yeah, and they are very chill there. You know, it's like very chill, like very relaxed. I really like that, you know. It's no stress. Okay, you know.
I'm not sure.
I feel that the South is more of a here and now culture compared to the Northeast, which is more of a dopamine culture.
Yeah, absolutely. I never thought of it, but you're hitting it right on the button. I think that's the case, right?
Mm? Yeah. Yes. Coming from the North, what are you going to do this weekend? catch up on some work. You know,
I'm just, what are your plans?
I'm going to go hunting and fishing. I'm going to have a wonderful time with my friends. There's something very healthy about that, in my opinion.
Mm. Well, killing stuff.
You got to eat.
Eating stuff.
Do you know, I was reminded of this story the other day. I was, I mentioned earlier before we started recording that I'd been in Washington State. Mm. And I drove across Washington State because I had to do some stuff at Snoqualmie Pass and a couple of other places. And I drove across the state and ended up in Spokane, where I had a tattoo done. And I got in a taxi to take me to the tattooists. And this guy was, he was of Native American descent. I don't know whether he was fully, I don't know. I mean, there's loads of tribes in Washington. So honestly, I've no clue. No expert on that by any stretch. We're driving along and he decided to tell me a funny story about how he'd been bow hunting a deer and it had moved at the last moment and he'd shot it up its ass. And I said, I appreciate you trying to tell me this in an amusing and lighthearted way, but I come from a country where we don't hunt shit for fun. And he said, hunt it for fun? I hunted it for food. I ate that thing and I had to track it for 2 hours to put it out of its misery. And I just looked at him and he was a big fat fucker. And I looked at him, I just said, dude, you are not in danger if you miss a couple of meals.
I do not hunt, and I couldn't hunt. I couldn't look at the animal through the sights and pull the trigger. But I would like to defend the hunters. And I would like to say that if you eat meat, you are causing the death of animals, and they're living in worse conditions than the animals that the hunters hunt. And the hunters are being more honest. If we eat meat, we're all killing the animals, but the hunters are being honest.
I've got to address some of this, right? One, yes and no. There's also a tremendous amount of waste, because if you field dress a deer, you're leaving most of the deer, all of which is actually useful. So field dressing a deer out in the arse end of nowhere, you're leaving seven eighths of the animal. But here's the other thing, like people are like, you know, it's me against the animal and all of that. And you just think, well, I tell you what, you go up against a fucking stag with a couple of bits of bone attached to your head, that's a level playing field. You go up against a bear with a weapon you have to use in your hand that doesn't fire a projectile, that's more like anybody. I don't see the sport in doing something from really far away other than the difficulty of actually taking the shot, in which case you might as well shoot at a target.
Yeah, but I think that we also have to keep in mind that the hunters are benefiting the prey. Because of the expansion of human settlements, the predators have been wiped out. Predators are much more fragile than prey. They need much more space. And so without the predators, the herds are going to be subject to disease and starvation. And so the human beings take the place of the predators. And hunters are more responsible for conservation. The money they spend buying hunter's licenses is the largest amount of money that goes to preserving wildlands. Mm. And they keep the prey healthy.
The way I'm not sure how we ended up this discussion here, but I give you one example. Okay, today a dog was I had an unfriendly encounter with a dog. Okay. And I learned from the dog owner that was at a small motel that she didn't like men with hats. And I had my Johnny Cash baseball hat on. And I tell you, and it's something, you know, like really archaic if you feel threatened by an animal, right? Like it's something we rarely encounter, like physical threat, right? Okay, this animal might bite me. Or this guy might hit me, or I don't know what, you know, something might eat me. I think it's a whole, it's like a sensation, a feeling that we rarely, rarely, rarely encounter because we live in such safe environments, I think mostly. But interestingly, you know, I took off the hat and you could bet him, you know, I waved at it, and it was like, and I waved at it, it was like, it was like, I mean, this dog has some serious trauma issues. Not Johnny Cash, my Johnny Cash baseball cap, okay?
Yeah, it took you for a moment back to your primitive past.
Absolutely.
When human beings were prey, and I don't know, maybe in some ways that was very life-giving.
Yeah, sometimes it's not so bad, you know, to feel a little bit threatened, isn't it?
Yes, I think
that's why
right.
We like UFC. I mean, maybe I'm the only one. I don't know. Usually among, you know, whatever, my acquaintances, friends are like, what, you watch this stuff? Yeah, I love it, man.
It's why we like roller coaster rides and skydiving, yeah.
Yeah, we come full circle back
to
the
dopamine. We like to feel like we might die while knowing we won't.
Yes.
But Michael, I'm going to wrap things up now because we are
we're going to do another half hour now. Okay, we have Dan here. No, but I mean there's lots of topics. I mean, we don't want to overstretch it, but then would you agree coming back?
I would love to come back. I've enjoyed this conversation so much.
Thanks. Listen, okay, then you're allowed to wrap it up, John. Okay?
To wrap it up, I'm going to give you a famous quote from the great philosopher Inspector Clouseau. When he sees a dog next to a gentleman, and he says, excuse me, does your dog bat? And the chap says, no. And he pets the dog, and the dog savages him, and he says, I thought you said your dog did not bite. And the guy says, that is not my dog.
I know, I love that movie. Yeah. I saw that hundreds of times.
Dan, it's been a genuine pleasure. And if you'd be willing to come back, I know Michael hasn't even made it through half of his notes.
Yeah, I mean, look, lots of
wow.
Nobody's ever had two post-its before.
I never had any post-its before.
Dan,
thank you so much for having me. Love to come back.
Thank you, Dan.